a true and tragic story. Rhonda Morrison was an 18-year-old young woman in Alabama. And in 1986, November 1st, 1986, Rhonda was tragically killed, found with someone had shot her multiple times in the back at the dry cleaners where she worked, just outside of there. About 7 months goes by, and there's no arrest in the case. And obviously, the small community in Alabama was really wanting to get this figured out, really wanted the person responsible for this to be arrested. And then in June of 1987, the following year, there was an arrest. And normally that would be good news. The killer brought to justice. And they arrested Walter McMillan. The problem was that even though there was a person who came forward and said that he was there, he saw it happen with his own two eyes, two other people came forward and said that they had seen his truck, a lowrider truck, parked outside of the dry cleaners the day that this had happened. Even though they had those testimonies, those witnesses, Mr. McMillan was at a church fish fry where there were dozens of people that witnessed and could testify that at that time that that tragic young girl was being was killed, that Mr. McMillan was at a fish fry 11 miles away and unable to be in that same place. Apparently that didn't seem to matter. And one tragedy then becomes even worse with the second tragedy. So he is arrested. And incredibly, the judge places him before the trial, 15 months before the trial, he is placed on death row. He hasn't even had a trial yet. And for 15 months before his trial, Mr. McMillan, Walter McMillan, a African-American man, is placed on death row when he hasn't even been convicted of a crime yet. Because to this judge, it seemed a foregone conclusion that he was guilty and that he was going to be condemned to death for his crime. 15 months later, he is tried before a jury. I don't know if it would be considered a jury of his peers because it moved it out of the community where he lived that was had a very large African-American community to another community, and the jury that they sat were 11 white people and one African-American. So it really wasn't a balanced jury of his peers, and the trial only lasted a day and a half. And at the end of that day and a half trial, the jury comes back with a guilty verdict. The jury, however, their sentencing, during the sentencing phase, was for life in prison, not the death penalty. But that didn't seem to satisfy the judge, so he overruled their sentence and said, no, this man deserves to die, and kept him on the death penalty. Now, kept him on death row, now as a convicted murderer. For 6 years, until finally some evidence came out that all of, right, not too long after that, those who said they saw his truck there, a lowrider truck, they recanted. They said it wasn't true. They really didn't see his lowrider truck. And there was evidence that the lowrider truck that they said they saw at the time of the murder wasn't a lowrider. Lowriders aren't made that way. You have to convert them into lowriders. And at the time of the murder, his truck was a normal truck. And the main witness who said he was there and had seen it with his own two eyes recanted. He said, no, it wasn't true. He said he had been forced to say what they wanted him to say. But none of that mattered until they found a tape, a cassette tape of his confession. And, you know, cassette tapes have two sides to it. They flipped over the side and listened to the other side. And on the other side was that same man, that same witness, complaining bitterly about being forced to give a false testimony about a man he didn't even know, claiming to be with him and to have seen him commit a murder that he knew nothing about. On that evidence, the conviction was overturned, and he was set free. You may have recognized the story. It was actually turned into a movie recently called Just Mercy that was released just in the last year and a half. True story. Well, as we get here to this message of Jesus and what is going on in his life, we see that we are now coming with Jesus to Golgotha, which in the Latin is where we get the word Calvary, and in the Greek it's Golgotha, which means the place of the skull. So we've gone with Jesus from the upper room, and we followed him along to the Garden of Gethsemane, where we left off last week, where he was arrested. And from his arrest at the Garden of Gethsemane, he now is on a path to the cross. And we're going to see today, we're going to go with Jesus and see the way to the cross, the path from the garden to the cross, and some of the stops that he makes along the way. And then we're going to look at the words that Jesus says, some of the words that he says from the cross, and then we're going to look at the work that Jesus accomplished on the cross. So let's look first at the way to the cross. The first place that it tells us in the Gospel of John that Jesus goes once he is arrested is they take him to the house of a man named Annas. And they call him and refer to him as the high priest. So Jesus is standing there and before Annas, the high priest. Now, you'll notice that in a moment they take him to the house of Caiaphas. And Caiaphas was also the high priest. So it's like, okay, which one is the high priest? Well, Annas was the high priest legitimately. But the Romans deposed him. The Romans removed him for some reason and placed Caiaphas, his son-in-law, as high priest. So even though he was removed as high priest and he wasn't officially under the Roman government, the high priest, all the Jews still saw him as the high priest because they weren't going to respect Rome removing one of their high priests. And in a sense, it's also like once you've been a pastor, even if you're not a pastor anymore, they still call you pastor. If you've been a president, they still call you president, even if you were president 40 years ago or 20 years ago. So he still remains and holds the title. So they take him first to the house of Caiaphas. And while he's there, we see a few things again that are occurring as he is at the house of Annas and then Caiaphas and then onto Pontius Pilate. The first injustice along the way is that the trial should not happen at night. He should not have been arrested at night, especially a capital murder trial, because that's what they were accusing him of. They wanted to kill Jesus, could not be held at night. The Sanhedrin had rules that they had to follow. God, in the law of Moses, gave them very specific rules on how they were to conduct the trial and how they were to treat people and how they were to have enough evidence to be able to condemn someone. And a trial should not be done at night. And it makes sense biblically because Jesus and the Bible talks about evening or night synonymous with darkness. And if you're doing a trial, it should be out in the light where there's truth. So they do this at night. Second, they shouldn't have questioned, Annas should not have been allowed to question Jesus. He should, if he's going to be tried, he should go before the Sanhedrin, before the council. There's no reason to take him to the house of who is, in essence, a private citizen at this point. He's not on the Sanhedrin. He's not part of the council. And yet he's being taken to this man's house so that he can be questioned by this man in a violation of his rights. When Jesus is there with him, before Annas, Annas is questioning him. And Jesus says to him, listen, everyone has heard me teach. I've taught in the temple. I've taught in the synagogues. Ask the people that have heard me what it is I have said. Let them speak. In other words, let others bear witness. When he said that, one of the soldiers came over, attendants, and hits Jesus across the face. He says, is that how you speak to the high priest? Another violation. I mean, it's one thing to try Jesus, but you can't just go up to prisoners that are on trial and beat them, hit them because you don't like what they said. Can you imagine that? This is not happening according to the rules. And Jesus says, well, if I said anything wrong, tell me what I've said. Prove it. And then it says in Matthew 25, 57, that from there, those who arrested Jesus took him to Caiaphas, the high priest, where there were teachers of the law and the elders had assembled. So they take Jesus. Another thing that's happening here, again, it's at night. They don't go to the council. They go to Caiaphas' house. Again, they shouldn't have been at his house either. Now, this is happening in the middle of the night. Jesus was arrested in the evening. He had the meal with the disciples, goes to the Garden of Gethsemane, and while he's in the garden, he is arrested. So it's in the evening. Hours are going by. This is now probably past midnight, early morning hours, somewhere between midnight and morning. They bring Jesus to Caiaphas' house, and it says the members have assembled. So they're having to get, you know, there are about 71 members of the Sanhedrin, the Jewish council. 71. So they had to get a lot of people together to wake them up, to tell them, okay, come now to Caiaphas' house. And I think there's some debate on whether all of the members were present. Because if you wanted to get, right, if you had already determined that this man is guilty, Caiaphas is the judge, and he has already determined Jesus' guilt, right? Just like the judge has already determined Walter's guilt. No, this man's guilty. We're going to condemn him. We're going to find a way to kill him. You're going to get a jury that's going to say what you want. And we know that Nicodemus was part of the Sanhedrin, part of the rule. You know, there were Pharisees who believed in Jesus. You're not going to take a chance and get those positive voices, those voices of reason, those voices that say, wait a minute, Caiaphas, we're not supposed to be here at night. What are you doing? This isn't, we got to follow the rules. So it's possible that not all 71 were there, but those who sympathized with Caiaphas. Another violation. He was not tried before a jury of his peers. And then the chief priests and the Sanhedrin were looking for false evidence against him. I mean, here it is. They were looking for false evidence. It doesn't even claim that they were looking for real witnesses. They were looking for false evidence so that they could put him to death. But they did not find any, though many false witnesses came forward. Finally, two came forward and declared, this fellow said, I am able to destroy the temple of God and rebuild it in 3 days. So he was speaking, obviously, of himself, his body as the temple that would be destroyed, but then come back in 3 days. So here we see, again, violations of Jesus' rights on the way to the cross. They knew the witnesses were false. They knew, and the inquiry should, or a trial, starts with witnesses. So they knew they were false. There was no attempt to find real witnesses, because a trial should be this way, right? It starts, Jewish trial has to start with an accusation. The Sanhedrin doesn't go and find and arrest someone first, and then try to find witnesses to convict them. That's not how it goes. First, there would be an accusation, and someone would say, hey, I witnessed this person committing a crime. I heard Jesus say something, and there had to be two witnesses, and they had to agree. Old Testament, two witnesses had to agree. It says here they had many witnesses. Many came forward, but they couldn't even agree, because if they had agreed, then Caiaphas would have said, all right, it's done. We've got 2, 3, 4, 5 witnesses all telling the same story. He's guilty. They couldn't even get 2 false witnesses to tell the same story to make any sense. But when an accusation was made, then normally the way it should work, it didn't work in the case of Jesus. It didn't work in the case of Walter McMillan. There's an accusation. Somebody says, hey, I think it might have been this guy that I saw, Walter, that I saw that night. It might have been his truck. Then the police go door to door. They start investigating. They start finding, hey, can anyone corroborate? Can anyone witness? What did you see? Good police work. They have to really try to not lead the witness, to not put thoughts into your head in order to make sure they get to the truth and don't end up convicting someone who's innocent. Well, in this case, they look for false witnesses. They arrest him before they even have anyone. And since no one can agree, no one can convict him, they finally come to Jesus himself. But Jesus remains silent. Fascinating. Through all of this, all of these false accusations, Jesus doesn't even bother to defend himself. He doesn't even bother to call them out. He doesn't need to, because none of their accusations stick, hold merit. The high priest said to him, I charge you under oath by the living God, tell us if you are the Messiah, the Son of God. So now he is, okay, nobody's making any sense. We're getting nowhere with these witnesses. So now he takes a different tactic. He just simply now says, by putting Jesus under an oath, I charge you, tell us, are you the Son of God, the Messiah? And here's Jesus' reply. Under that line of questioning, Jesus responds, you have said so. Jesus replied, but I say to you, from now on, you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven. When Jesus says that, Caiaphas yells out, blasphemy! He at that moment understands what Jesus has just said, is acknowledging, is declaring himself to be the Son of God, the Messiah. Caiaphas tears his robes, which is a sign of disgust and protest. He tears his robes and he says, what else do we need to hear? What do you all say? And they all start to say, guilty. He deserves death. And that's not enough. They themselves begin to beat Jesus right there in Caiaphas' house. We don't need to get into it too much, but you know what happens. But it's interesting the words that Jesus uses and why Caiaphas' response. He says, Caiaphas asked him, are you the Son of God? But Jesus says, you will see the Son of Man. Probably referring to Daniel chapter 7. In Daniel chapter 7, Daniel sees a vision. And this is what he says. In my vision at night, I looked, and there before me was one like a Son of Man. Literally meaning like one who was looked like a human, who was like a human being, coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence. He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. All the nations and peoples of every language worshipped him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away, and his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed. So Jesus is referring, see, they understood that Son of Man that Daniel saw was referring to the Messiah. And the difference between the Son of Man and the way he sees him, resembling a human and not just God in all of his glory, but this is the Messiah, this is the Son of Man. And the reason it's important is because the Son of God means he has come from God, he is one with God. But the Son of Man in this image is representing his victory, his glory, that he is the one, that, like Paul says, the second Adam. And we see that in Revelation, because in Revelation chapter 1, the Apostle John says he was in the Spirit on the Lord's day. He begins to hear this voice behind him. And he turns around. And he describes what he sees. He starts off by saying, I saw one who was like the Son of Man. Same words. But this is how John describes the Son of Man. His hair was white like wool. There was a golden sash across his chest. His eyes burned like fire. His face like the sun in all of its brilliance. His feet were like burning bronze in the furnace. And when he spoke, it was like the thunder of rushing waters. And out of his mouth came a double-edged sword. And he spoke and he said, I am the Alpha and the Omega, the first and the last, the beginning and the end. Behold, I was dead, and now I am alive, and I hold the keys of death and Hades. Amen. So when they heard Jesus say this, they knew exactly what he was saying. So they said, blasphemy. But when somebody makes a claim, he should have the right to prove it. He should have the right to prove it. Jesus said, I am the Son of Man. And there was no, okay, well, prove it. Okay, well, where's the evidence? Okay, give it to us. Explain to us how you are the Son of Man. None of that. Just with his declaration, they already had assumed you are not the Son of Man. And he says, what should we do? He is worthy of death. This is another problem, another injustice, because no death trial could be held on a holy day or during a holy festival. So they've already broken that. This is the day of preparation. This is leading into the Passover, and it's also before Sabbath. You are not allowed to try someone on this day. It's a holiday. So they've done it at night. They've done it on the holy day. They're breaking all of the rules. And you weren't allowed to sentence someone to death on the same day as their trial. So in the Jewish law, if you were convicted, if you were tried and convicted of death, the sentencing was supposed to happen at least the next day. So everyone had a chance to calm down, to consider and weigh what they were doing, because a man or a woman's life was in their hands. None of that happened. And then they take him to Pilate, Pontius Pilate. And when they get to Pilate, another thing they do is they change the charges against him. They charge him and find him guilty of blasphemy. But when they go to Pilate, that doesn't matter to Pilate. Pilate doesn't care if he says he's the king of the Jews or the Messiah. So they say, well, he's telling people not to pay taxes to Caesar. That's the first accusation among Pilate. Now, it's very interesting because when we get to Pontius Pilate and how he's described outside of the Bible, this is what was written about Pontius Pilate. He was a cruel, murderous man. He incited the Jews. He was known for killing without a trial. Historians and scholars have generally been much less kind to Pilate than the Gospels. According to Philo of Alexandria, he was a man of inflexible, stubborn, and cruel disposition, and is on record for killing suspects without trial. He ordered his troops to carry an imperial image of Caesar into the temple. He once surrounded a mob of several thousand people in a stadium and threatened to chop off their heads. On another occasion, he ordered his men to infiltrate a demonstration and beat up everyone they could get their hands on. His career ended when he was called to Rome, presumably for excessive cruelty. So this is a guy who has a history of... He will lead a total of 10 years in Jerusalem. And he's brutal. He crucifies people all the time. It's a weekly thing. It's not something new. And he doesn't care if they're, especially if they're not Roman, he doesn't care if they're just or tried. It doesn't matter if it suits him and if it pleases the people. I mean, for this guy to be sent back to Rome for excessive cruelty, that's why it's fascinating the way that we find him in the Gospels. Now it's about dawn. It's about between 5, 6, 6:30 in the morning. It's early morning. The sun is coming up, and they're coming and knocking on Pilate's door. Pilate comes out. They don't want to go into his palace. It was called the Praetorium. They didn't want to go in there because they would become, as Jewish people, they would become unclean. And if they became unclean right before the Passover, they would not be able to celebrate the Passover. So they stay out in the street. And Pilate has to come out to them early in the morning. Jesus has been up all night. They're throwing all of these accusations at Jesus, and Jesus doesn't say a word. And as Jesus is sitting there, it says that Pilate goes out, and Jesus did not reply once. He didn't say one single word, to the great amazement of the governor. So it starts off by his first impression of Jesus. He's blown away. There's something about this guy. And it probably tells us that every other person that ever went before Pilate was begging for their lives. What was telling how those accusations are all false. Don't believe them, Pilate. The Caiaphas, he's out to get me. They're here asking for his death. And Jesus doesn't say a word. And Pilate is like, I've never seen this. So Pilate takes Jesus inside his palace. He takes him inside, away from the Jews, and he starts to question him and ask him. And he says, well, are you a king? Right? They're saying you're king of the Jews. You're proclaimed to be a king. Are you a king? And he says, my kingdom is not of this world. He says, yeah, I am a king. My kingdom is not of this world. So at this moment, Jesus is saying, you know, as Jesus the man, or even the Son of God and the Son of Man, my kingdom is in heaven. This world has been dominated, has been stolen away by the prince of darkness, right? But and I am not of this world. Pilate goes out and he says, come on, I find nothing wrong with him. I sent him to Herod. Herod sent him back to me. Neither one of us find anything wrong with him. I'll tell you what, I'm going to punish him and then set him free. And they're like, no, no, you cannot do that. He claimed to be the Son of God. It says when Pilate heard that, he became even more afraid. So now you have this cruel murdering dictator afraid. Because when he heard that, remember, what's going through his mind? He probably doesn't believe in the God of the Jews. He may believe in a supernatural power, but remember the Greek mythology? Zeus and would commonly, all the mythology, the myth and the legend would be that Zeus frequently would appear and interact with humans. So the idea here that this is the Son of God, his theology was probably all wrong, but he's still probably thinking, oh my goodness, maybe this could be Son of God. So he brings Jesus back in again, and he says, tell me who you are. And Jesus, again, it doesn't say much to him, and he says, don't you know I have the power to either set you free or have you crucified? And Jesus says, you would have no power if it wasn't given to you by my Father in heaven. Pilate is like, he goes back out, and he says again, I find no reason for crucifying him. I am going to have him punished and then set him free. And they say no. So finally it says Pilate relents. Pilate hands him over to be crucified. And then they take him back into the praetorium, back into the palace. And that's where it tells us that the guards put a crown of thorns on his head. They hit his head with rods. So think of maybe not a bat, but think of like a clothes rod you would hang clothes on, something an inch thick or so, and they're hitting him. So the concussions, the daze, it's incredible he didn't get knocked unconscious. And maybe he did, it just doesn't tell us periodically or momentarily. And then they flog him. Again, this is not like a beating with rods. Paul was beaten with rods. The flogging, I'm not going to get into it because it is incredibly graphic. I will just say that people who historically wrote about the Roman floggings say that you could, for those who have been flogged, there it's possible for their flesh to be torn off so much that their ribs and their internal organs would be visible. Probably all of this was an attempt by Pilate to get them to set Jesus free. Because the two thieves that were crucified on Jesus' side, they didn't seem to have been so severely beaten as Jesus was. So then now Jesus goes from the praetorium and he's on his way to the cross. And they put Jesus on the cross. They put nails through his hands or his wrists and his feet. And they crucify him between two thieves. And they begin to hurl insults at him. And Jesus says seven statements from the cross. We're only going to look at five. And the first one is this. Jesus said, as they were hurling insults at him, Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they are doing. And they divided up his clothes by casting lots. After everything that's happening... But we expect this from Jesus. Anything other than this from Jesus would not fit with everything he has done and everything he has said. He said he came to make forgiveness possible, to seek and to save that which was lost. So if Jesus now said, I hate you, or if he said, God, Father, judge them, it would make sense to us. Because we would be thinking or feeling the same way, but it would go so against everything that Jesus, and we see that who Jesus is and is about. So what do we see here? Jesus, forgiveness is what he came to do. And he is not holding this against them. And he is asking the Father also to not hold it against them. Another interesting thing is that Jesus prayed the night before. We know that at this, the judgment and the wrath of God is going to be placed on him. Yet he is still talking to his father. So when we get mad at people, you know, how many of you, oh, don't raise your hand, your go-to when you're mad is the silent treatment. Jesus doesn't give the father the silent treatment. In the moment of pain, in the moment that he's drinking the wrath of his father, he is still addressing him as father. And then he's asking for forgiveness. And it reminds me of when Jesus, forgiveness for them, it reminds me of when Jesus told Peter when he washed his feet in the upper room, Peter, unless I wash your feet, you have no part with me. And I said it had to do probably with Jesus understanding and wanting him to understand, this is what I've called you to. I've called you to serve. That's what it means to be my follower. Well, Jesus said, freely you have received, freely give, right? We have been forgiven. Jesus said, as you have been forgiven, whoever you forgive will be forgiven. If we follow Jesus, if we have been forgiven, how can we refuse forgiveness to others? How can we, this is the essence of who Jesus is. How can we refuse forgiveness to others? It's not easy. It's not easy to forgive. And obviously, the more you've been hurt, the harder it is to let go. I was watching last night a documentary about Tina Turner. And Tina Turner, in her early career, was married to Ike Turner and had about a 16, 18-year marriage that was extremely abusive. And people kept, after she got away from that, people kept asking her about that. In the 80s, they'd keep in interviews, and she'd say, come on, I don't want to talk about, I don't want to relive it. And when the more you've been hurt, the harder the pain, the deeper the pain, you'll understand that forgiveness isn't something you just do once. You have to forgive the person that has hurt you for the rest of your life on an ongoing basis. Because every time you remember the pain, you have to forgive again. You have to say, Lord, I forgive them. Because the pain comes back. Tina Turner wrote a book in order to stop having to answer the questions. And then the book got turned into a movie. And then they would ask her about the movie and the story again. And she's like, when am I going to get away from this? And then she even said about her mom. She says, my mom was not good to me. She didn't want me. Even the things when I got successful and I bought her a house and I bought her a car, I was doing these things. And she's like, no, Tina, you, no. But this is what Tina says. I did for her as if she loved me. She didn't want me. She didn't love me. I didn't get any love from her, but I did for her as if she did love me. That is what Jesus is doing on the cross. We've done nothing to deserve his love. We've done everything to not deserve his love, yet he is still treating us as if we loved him. Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. And then the next words of Jesus on the cross, he said, Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom. Now, this is what was said by the two thieves. Remember, he was crucified on the cross between two thieves. That fulfills the prophecies in the Old Testament that say he was counted among the transgressors, among sinners in his death. And these two men are at first it seems they're both insulting Jesus. But at some point, one of them realizes, one of them has a change of heart. And he says, remember me, Jesus, when you come into your kingdom. And Jesus answers him, truly, I tell you, today you will be with me in paradise. Today you will be with me in paradise. So Jesus being hung between two sinners, it shows the length to which he has identified with us. It shows the length to which he has gone to be one of us, that he died among the sinners. And here's the thing, when they accused Jesus his whole life, right, or his whole ministry, what were the accusations about him, the criticisms about him? One of them was that he's always around sinners. He goes into their homes. He eats with them. He hangs out with them. And now in his death, he is literally hanging between two sinners. Jesus, to that degree, has gone to identify with us. And then that man on the cross, next to Jesus, he tells the other one, he yells over at the other one. And this is amazing because Jesus' seven statements, the longest really is that first one. And the second one, these are probably done in the early morning hours. Jesus was crucified around 9 a.m. And these statements are most likely said in the early part. As it gets later, Jesus, his statements are very short. He's not going to have the strength, the energy. When you're being crucified, you don't die from losing blood. You die from suffocation. You can no longer breathe. In case you didn't know that, you're hanging. And it gets to a point where the only way you can breathe is to pull yourself up just enough to get a breath and back down. And normally you die of exhaustion. You just, the pain, every time you breathe, the nails are press against your bones. And it gets to a point where you're just too exhausted and you can't breathe anymore. So any words that he would say, again, that's why you don't say very much and you don't hear Jesus saying very much. He's not going to be dialoguing with people for very long. And he's on the cross, and he said, and the other thief says, you know, he realizes who Jesus is, and he says, will you remember me when you come into my kingdom? So what is it that this thief has done? Why can Jesus say to him, today you will be with me in paradise? Because he confesses his sin, and he confesses his faith in Jesus. And that's it. When they ask Peter, what must I do to be saved? Peter says to them in Acts, repent and believe and be baptized, right? So repent and believe. That man repented and believed, even though nobody really told him necessarily, but he looked at Jesus and he looked at the other man and said, we are sinners. We deserve what we are getting. But this man is innocent. And when he says, remember me when you come into your kingdom, he's acknowledging that he is a king, that he is the Messiah, the Son of God. So he confessed his sin and he confessed his faith in Jesus. And that's all it took. You know, when Pilate led Jesus out, he asked the Pharisees, he asked the Sanhedrin, then what do I do with Jesus? Remember last week we ended the service saying, what will you do with Jesus? Well, he asked them, what should I do with Jesus? He asked the wrong people. The next thing Jesus says from the cross, this says it was 3 p.m. Now it's the 6th hour. It's been 6 long hours. Jesus cried out in a loud voice, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani, which means, my God, why have you forsaken me? I believe that through this entire experience, because from noon it says darkness covered the land, and it may have been the most intense in those last 3 hours. And it may have been, again, darkness representing God turning away. And right at this moment, after the 6 hours on the cross, he says, my God, why have you forsaken me? I believe it's most intense at this moment that the wrath of God, the judgment of God for our sin and the separation of fellowship with the Father, and it was the most intense at this moment. That he says, my God, why have you forsaken me? But then he only had to look down and say, that's why. They are why. And it says that at that very moment, the curtain in the temple was torn in two. Now, the temple had two rooms. The holy place, and then this huge curtain, it was 60 feet high. I've heard it was up to 4 inches thick. It was this huge curtain that separated the holy place. And when you went past the curtain, you went into the Holy of Holies. I mean, just the name, the Holy of Holies. The Ark of the Covenant was there with the Ten Commandments inside of it. And it represented the very presence of God. Only the high priest could go into the Holy of Holies, and only once a year. And that was to ask for atonement and forgiveness for the sins of Israel. That curtain represented that we were not permitted into God's presence. And at that moment that he said, my God, why have you forsaken me? God answers by ripping the curtain from top to bottom. So God tears it apart. He's saying at that point, that's why the very next words out of Jesus' mouth is, it is finished. The work is done. That curtain being torn means the work is done. The cup of God's wrath that he had to endure and take, he had done it. He had made it through. And he says, it is finished. When we hear that word, if you've been in Easter services for any length of time, you've probably heard that it's one word in the Greek, and it's tetelestai, but it's used in multiple ways. It's used to represent when a task or a command has been completed or fulfilled, or when there's nothing left to do or pay. So, for example, a servant finishes what they've been asked to do, and they come back and they say, everything's done, the house is clean. There's nothing left to do. It's done. Or a soldier is given an order, and he fulfills the order, and he comes back and he says, it's done, everything is done, there's nothing else to do. An artist who paints a painting and steps back from it and says, it's finished, it's done. Or when you've made payment and you make the last payment and the debt is canceled, it's done, it's paid in full, you don't owe another cent. That's the word that Jesus says. It's done. The debt has been paid. Nothing else is owed. It is finished. And then just as he started by praying to the Father for the forgiveness of those that were crucifying him, he ends by Jesus calling out in a loud voice, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. And he said this, he breathed his last. So he never turned his back on the Father. Instead, he surrenders his spirit. He commits his spirit into the hands of the Father, the one who had just judged him for us. So those were Jesus' words on the cross. And then we look very quickly here to wrap it up. We may get into this more next week as we see what Jesus did on the cross. Jesus' work on the cross. I want to look at that word, it is finished. Well, what is the it? The wrath of God has been satisfied. God's wrath. That's why when we look at God and we ask, is God a God of anger? And at times you look in the Old Testament and people will read the Old Testament and believe that God was angry. But then we get into the New Testament and we see, no, God was angry at sin and all of the pain that it was causing. But God is not an angry God who loves. He's a loving God. And everywhere in the Old Testament, when it talks about God's anger, it says he was aroused to anger. His anger was kindled. He's not an angry God that sometimes can be compassionate. He is a loving God who we have to incite and arouse to anger. But here it is finished. His anger, his wrath has been satisfied. The ransom has been paid and justice has been served. The debt has been paid. Jesus said he comes to give his life as a ransom, the price for our freedom. So if you're with us this morning, you're listening, and you know Jesus, then this is motive for great joy, for great celebration, for great reverence and honor for what Jesus has done for us. But if you don't know Jesus, if you don't know that love, then I'll just say, do what the sinner on the cross did. Confess your sin and confess your faith in Jesus. Believe in him for your salvation. Believe in him for the forgiveness of your sins. And if you'd like to, I'd like to lead you in a prayer to make that a reality today. Will you pray with me? Jesus, I confess my sin before you. I repent. I am a sinner. No excuses. And I confess my faith in you as the Son of God, the only Son of God, the Messiah, the Deliverer. I confess that you died on the cross and shed your blood to satisfy my debt And I accept that. I receive it. In Jesus' name. And I want to let you know, if you're thinking about this, I want to remind us, Jesus willingly gave his life. Remember, he said, nobody takes it from me. He willingly gave his life for us so that we could have his righteousness on us. He willingly took our sin so that we could take his righteousness. But just like he willingly took our sin, nobody forced it on him, he's not going to force his righteousness on you. You have to willingly accept what he did on the cross. And I hope that you did this morning.